KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Seattle.
It is not a short-term concern. There are no immediate health hazards in the state of Washington as a result of this leak.
Feeling and knowing that life is short and I have to explore and make the best out of it.
You guys are just standing up because you feel bad that I fell, and that's really embarrassing, but thank you. This is nuts.
It's Oscar-winning actress Jennifer Lawrence after she tripped running up the stairs last night. We're going to talk more about Oscars later this hour. You're listening to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. Six underground waste storage tanks at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation are leaking. Governor Jay Inslee, as you heard earlier ago, said there was no immediate health risk, but he says it's still disturbing news. And joining us with more is our Richland correspondent, Anna King. And I have a huge echo, Anna, so I hope you can hear me.
I can hear you. I'm sorry about the echo.
Okay. Not sure where that's coming from. But Anna, last week we had heard it was a tank leaking. Now it's six tanks leaking. How much radioactive waste are we talking about here?
We're talking about 56 million gallons of radioactive waste that's stored out at Hanford. And this is all in aging underground tanks. I mean, think of a ship from World War II or the Cold War in the ocean water. Now think of that underground, and that's what we're dealing with here. These are big, huge tanks about the size of a house, and they're full of this radioactive sludge and liquid waste.
These are single-shelled tanks that are leaking?
Well, there are a total of six single-shell tanks leaking and one double-shell tank leaking. Double-shell tanks are a little bit stronger. They have two walls or two holes, and single-shell tanks just have that one layer between the tank waste and the environment.
As I understand it, there are more than 100 tanks, right, altogether?
And that's correct. There's 177 tanks altogether.
And are we sure that only six are leaking?
We're not sure, actually. Governor Inslee last week announced that some very disturbing news. He characterized it as very disturbing. And he said, you know, we know that these six tanks are leaking so far, but the Department of Energy is doing additional testing with its contractor that manages the tank farms out there. And they are trying to see if there are possibly additional tanks beyond the seven that we know that are leaking now.
How did the news of the leaks come to light in the first place?
Well, a few weeks ago, about February 15th, we heard that one tank of waste was possibly leaking. And, you know, it's difficult to dial down. You'd think that this would be a simple process. They'd put some kind of dipstick down there and they'd know how much waste is in there. But just an inch or two of waste level drop can mean, you know, hundreds of gallons of waste that has gone into the ground or evaporated. And so it's very difficult to tell. And beyond that, barometric pressure, the temperature, it all can like expand and contract the waste. And so it's kind of difficult to tell sometimes. Added to that is the possibility that some water might be seeping inside these tanks, adding to the tank waste, masking a tank leak. And so it's very difficult for the contractors and the Department of Energy to tell. That being said, it's a very important job to know how much waste is in those tanks and how much might be getting out.
Wow. So why didn't we know about this any sooner?
I think that we don't know that yet. I've been asking very pointed questions to the Department of Ecology, the Department of Energy, the federal watchdogs, that this must have come up before, or maybe they knew before, or what was going on. And they say that they're looking at data just a little bit wrong, that they were looking at a very narrow scope of data and they should have been looking at larger trends to kind of see what was going on with the tanks over many, many years to kind of identify these trends. And, you know, that's what I'll be reporting on in the weeks to come is how could they have missed this? Who was looking at this data? Was this data held from the state and not given to state watchdogs to watch this waste? What's going on?
So it's a private company that manages the tanks. Is that right?
Yeah, there have been several different contractors out there. These tanks are grouped in kind of pods called farms, and they're really eerie looking. If you imagine a gravel parking lot with all kinds of tubes and fencing around them and stacks and monitoring wells, and they kind of look like something off of the Jedi movie or something. It's pretty surreal. And when they're out there, they wear suits and they're very well protected, the workers, but they are really trying to just determine how much waste is in these tanks at this point.
We're talking with our Richland correspondent, Anna King, reporter for the Northwest News Network. And Anna, you talked about they're wearing suits and they're well protected, and yet, according to Governor Inslee, there's no immediate danger caused by the leak. So which is it? Is this dangerous or not?
Well, if the tank waste was to leak out or to burp out of a tank or get near a worker, that would be a very serious incident. In fact, that's happened in the past during tank transfers. But immediately to the public downstream in Portland, over in your area in Seattle, this is a huge concern, but it is not going to cause you cancer tomorrow. Basically, this waste that is leaking out is possibly going down into the ground and into the soil below. And then it has a long journey between the soil that is with groundwater before it hits the groundwater and is carried out towards the Columbia River, which is nearby. And so, yeah, it is concerning, but there are a lot of smart minds, a lot of scientists working on the problem, and they are trying to find solutions for this. That said, this is very, very dangerous stuff. Some have characterized it as the most contaminated site in the world, and it's not to be taken lightly that this stuff is leaking out.
So we've got these six leaking tanks. Do they patch the tanks? Do they transfer the waste? What happens with the stuff that is in the leaky tanks?
Well, that's the question going forward. How can we stabilize these tanks? They're very difficult kind of bodies to work with. They're like a layer cake, if you could imagine that. You know, if you had a layer of frosting and then a layer of hard, crumbly filling and then a layer of soft, spongy cake. The tanks are kind of in those same configurations. They have these different layers of waste depending on the chemical process they were using at the time and how the chemicals kind of separate out. We've all done those experiments when we were in junior high or high school of where you poured a whole bunch of stuff in a beaker and then it separated out into layers. And so that's what's happened in these tanks. And so liquid waste might very well be trapped between two layers of very hard salt cake material, mm-hmm. or thick muddy material. And so it's not just as simple as sticking a straw down in there and sucking out the moisture. It is a very difficult operation. They do this all with robotics and very sophisticated arms, like kind of the same kind of equipment they might use on a space shuttle.
It's amazing. So while we're talking about all these tanks, in the meantime, a waste treatment facility is looming not too far down the road, a few years, 2019, I think. So there's a gap here. What's going to happen in those 6 years? Are we going to see inspections increase diligence with the other 171 tanks?
Well, there's several large questions, like you said. The big issue, I think, is that they've got, you know, these leaking tanks. So that is something that everybody is very concerned with and trying to fix. But this plant that they're building is in very much in question at this point. Several huge governmental watchdogs have called into question this tank. There's been management strife. Several top managers or safety experts on this project have brought up concerns and testified in federal hearings that they're concerned about this plant. Some of the big questions are, will there be a hydrogen gas explosion in this plant, or could they change all of the filters that are supposed to protect the public if there was another St. Helens event and the filters got clogged with ash? So there was one report that said there might be 7,000 filters that would need to be changed in a 24-hour period. That report just came out a few months ago, and you know, these are not just your home heater furnace filter. These are filtering out radioactive waste and dangerous chemicals.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, Anna, that you know, people in Portland and Seattle don't have to worry quite yet. But what about the Tri-Cities? What are people on the streets nearby saying about what's happening?
Well, the big news, as you probably know, broke late Friday afternoon, last Friday, and I was working, you know, really, really difficult stories trying to get the information out that more tanks were, in fact, leaking before the news deadlines. After that, I kind of needed a beer, so I took my husband over to the local watering hole. It's called Shrubstep Brewery. That's named after, you know, the desert plateau that we kind of live on, and we sucked down a couple Vados beers, and Vados means the dry area between where the tank waste leaks out and it hits the groundwater. So
that dry
profile of soil. And we had a couple IPAs there, Vados beer IPAs, and talking to the local scientists and everybody around, everybody is really concerned about this. But, you know, we live in a community where your next door neighbor is working at the tank farms. Somebody down the road at your gym is one of the scientists out there. You know, it's kind of part of our community. And I think that there is a very realistic view. But, you know, we're not moving or selling real estate yet.
Well, that's good to know, because we need you there reporting it. Just a last question, you know, sort of looming in Washington, D.C. is the federal sequestration budget cuts. How would that impact any, if at all, the cleanup or the inspection of these tanks or any kind of further action?
That is a very big question. You know, to build new tanks to put this waste in might cost $150 million and take 5 years if they started today, as some of the estimates I've heard out there. They don't have a lot of time. They need to fix this problem of these leaking tanks. And the sequester is coming at the exact wrong time. The Department of Energy Energy Secretary Stephen Chu has said that given a sequester possibility, that they would, in fact, have to cross the board cut workers at Hanford, including those that work in the tank farms. And so this comes at the very worst moment, and everybody is very concerned about it. These are huge tanks. Some of them can hold more than 1 million gallons of waste or 500,000 gallons of waste.
Wow.
It's not to be taken lightly.
Well, Anna, thanks for your vigilance on these stories, and we'll talk with you again soon.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Anna King is a reporter for Northwest News Network. She's based in Richland, Washington.
Anna spoke with KOW's Marcy Silman. Polar explorer Borg Ausland joins us to talk about what he's seen on his adventures across the North and South Poles in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and the Strom JCC present the 18th annual Seattle Jewish Film Festival, March 2nd through 10th, featuring the film series Jews in the Arts, with films about Art Spiegelman, Roman Polanski, and Broadway musicals, plus special events and family programming. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
44 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says mostly cloudy all day with scattered showers and wind. Gusts up to 40 miles an hour today, an afternoon high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:19. Later this hour, Oscar Extravaganza will be joined by playwright David Schmader and filmmaker Sandy Siafi to talk about last night's Academy Awards, winners and losers, and, of course, the spectacle itself. That's 20 minutes away.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on vacation. What does climate change look like? A lot of scientists and politicians say we can blame our blistering hot summer and frigid winter on global climate change. National Geographic polar explorer Borg Ausland has actually seen the impact from a different perspective. Borg Ausland is the first person to make a solo crossing of Antarctica. In 2010, he made a complete circumnavigation of the Arctic Ocean, and in his spare time, he leads expeditions, he lectures, and he writes books, and he's in Seattle and joins us in the studios. Thank you for joining us. And before we talk about climate change, I want to talk about anybody's decision to be a polar explorer.
Well, it's not a decision that just pops into your head like that. I think it's something that grew on me since I was a child, really. Even though I didn't know that I was going to be a polar explorer when I was growing up, it was always adventures and wanting to see what was beyond the horizon that made me do the first trip across Greenland, but that was just with two friends just to try it out, really, and then I took it from there.
You're from Norway.
Yeah.
So did you grow up in the northern part near where?
No, I grew up just outside Oslo, but we still have, you know, white winters with lots of skiing and spending times outdoors. So I grew up with skis on my feet, so I can say that.
Well, so it's one thing for somebody to be an adventurer and like to, you know, go mountain skiing or backcountry skiing. The poles, the polar regions are backcountry times, you know, to the nth degree. I would imagine.
Yeah, it's a long way. But then again, you know, everything is a gradual slope or upward hill. And when you're first covered the first step, then you can go to the next one. So I started with Greenland, and then I did North Pole with a couple of friends, and then I did French Joseph Land. And then so gradually starting to do more and more difficult expedition, and then finally into solo trips where I did solo to the North Pole, solo to the South Pole, solo across Antarctica, and solo across the North Pole again. So for me at earlier stage, I wouldn't dream about doing that. But then you get better and you know more and you get more experienced.
When was that first polar trip?
First one, that was a long time ago, in 1986, when the world were still without global warming and the Arctic was just like it always been.
Icy and big.
Yeah.
So I have to do some quick math here. That's about 28 years ago or so. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
So how let's talk about climate change a second. You circumnavigated the Arctic Ocean.
Mm.
That was just a couple of years ago. What's the difference between what you saw in 86 and what you saw in 2010?
Well, I have to compare with 1990 because that's when I did the first North Pole trek. Mm. And in those days, the ice up there was 50 to 60% of the ice in the polar ocean was 3 to 4 meter thick, and now it's reduced by 30% in thickness, but also in the coverage. So there's a huge loss of ice mass on the Arctic Ocean. And what's special about that is that this white protective shield up there usually reflects most of the energy from the sun, up to 90% of the energy. So when that is replaced by open water, it's the opposite that's happening. The dark surface of the water absorbs energy, just like a dark car becomes hotter than a white car, and the water temperature rises, and that is actually the main reason why the temperature in the Arctic is rising twice as fast as the global average. So, and that's really no stopping it. And I think we're actually past the tipping point when it comes to the drift ice in the Arctic.
Well, what will that mean?
That's not nice.
No, that doesn't sound like a good thing. No. Past the tipping point means it's irreversible.
It's irreversible, most likely, which means that it will still be ice there in the winter, because whenever the sun goes down below the horizon, it becomes cold again. But during the summer, we will probably lose the drift ice in the Arctic Ocean, which, of course, has a huge impact on humans, of course, living there, but also animal life.
We're talking with polar explorer Borg Ausland, and the first trip you made was 1990, so there was a 20-year span. Did the changes happen gradually, or was
it,
there?
Yeah, it happens gradually, but it happens faster and faster.
Right, so there's an acceleration.
Yes, and the models the scientists are having or and projecting for into the future, the reality is outside the models. So it happens faster than the models. So we don't really have good enough mathematic models to project into the future.
So as an explorer, as an adventurer, do you do scientific sampling as well?
Yeah, I do what I can do, and that is to measure ice thickness. So I've done that on most of my North Pole expedition, which means that I measure physically the ice thickness as I go.
With like a tape measure or ruler?
Tape measure, simply.
Wow.
Easy. Basic science. And then scientists can compare that with data from satellite imaging, things like that. So that's accurate measurements that I've been doing for 20 years up there in connection with the Norwegian Polar Institute. So I give the data to them and they collect it and make sense out of it.
Do you also log wildlife, or is there no wildlife that far north?
Oh, there is wildlife that far north, absolutely. And it's the pack ice of the Arctic Ocean is really the big engine in the food chain up there. You would think about the ice as something barren and desolate, really without food, but you have to think underneath the ice. That's where it's all happening. And you have algae growing underneath the ice, which is, again, food for shrimps and small animals, which, again, is food for fish and birds and seals and whales and polar bears at the top. So without ice, there is really not much life in the Arctic Ocean. So the whole food chain is dependent on the pack ice up there.
We're talking with Borg Ausland. He's going to be speaking this evening at Benner Royal Hall and tomorrow evening at 7:30 at Benner Royal Hall. Antarctica, it seems to me a far more mysterious place than the North Pole. I don't know why I have that impression. So when did you first go to the South?
First time I was down there was in 1995. Then I did a solo trip to the South Pole from the coast. So that was about 1,350 kilometers.
And you did that solo?
Yeah, solo. And then the next year I did another classical first, which was the crossing of the Antarctic continent from the Weddell Sea to the Ross Sea, which meant via the South Pole. So it's a long way.
And what mode of locomotion did you use to take yourself across? Do you go on a...
Skiing.
On human-powered skis.
Human-powered skis. On my own legs, pulling that heavy sled from day one to the end.
How long did that take?
Took me 64 days, so it's not too bad, actually. It was a fast trip. I was strong then.
Yeah, how does one get permission to do something like this?
Well, Antarctica is more or less international territory, so it's governed by a group of countries, so you just really need permission from one of the states that have signed the Antarctic Treaty, and Norway is a part of that, so that's pretty easy. You just have to cover yourself for eventual rescue kind of assurance and things like that, and then you can go.
What do you need to do mentally to prepare yourself for that?
Well, mentally, it's not always easy to prepare yourself for something that you don't really know what's going to happen. So I usually leave that to the trek itself and what happens on the way. But there is always something and some shocks out there. And in Antarctica, I think the landscape itself, which you describe as something more mysterious than other places, and it's true because it's so grand, it's so big, it's beautiful, but at the same time it's extremely barren and very few impulses from the outside. It's the same every day, so I think that Antarctica is a bigger mental challenge just because of the landscape. There is nothing going on. You don't have any inputs. While at the North Pole, you have pack ice and polar bears, and sure, you might have to work on something and you have to make decisions. So that's why I think it's a bigger psychological factor to do a huge solo trip in Antarctica than at the North.
What made you want to do this in the first place?
Antarctica or in general?
Let's talk about Antarctica. But in general, I mean, some people like to go up to the mountains for, you know, a little week of solo skiing or camping.
Yeah, but then again, I don't do it because it's dangerous or that I want to get closer to death or something like that. It's actually the opposite. I want to get closer to life. When I call myself an explorer, it's also because I want to explore what life has in it on all levels. And of course, a solo trip, that's taking it to the maximum where you not only explore what you see on the trip, but also something inside you, which I think is quite interesting. And I reached levels inside me that I didn't know existed on these trips. And that's, of course, because there is no one else to lean on. And then you're forced to have a different dialogue with yourself and also the nature.
What were your biggest worries about going off the first time you went on a long solo trip?
Well, the biggest worries in the first trip was, of course, that maybe I wouldn't be able to cope with being alone for a long time. And I had no idea, because when I did my first solo trip in 94, skiing alone to the North Pole, I had never spent one night alone in the tent. So I do.
Wait, you didn't do a practice trip or anything?
No, I didn't. I didn't see any point, because it's such a big difference between sleeping alone in a tent in the mountains of Norway that at the North Pole. So I thought, okay, I'll just have to grab the bulls by the horns and do it.
Oh, my gosh.
So the first few days on that trip, I felt like the biggest idiot in the world. And I thought, this is never going to work. But then again, you don't want to give up. Huh? So I kept on going a little bit and a little bit more. And then gradually, you know, you get into the routine and then starting to believe that you will make it after all. So it's a very... it's a very mental process you're going through there. But what's interesting about this mental process is that it's not something concrete. It's not very physical. It's about feelings. And you have to know that feelings will pass by if you give it some time and if you work on it. So that was the secret for me. But I didn't train on it beforehand, no.
You had to learn that on the way.
Yeah, but it's not really complicated. You know, people can do amazing things if they are forced to do it.
Borg Ausland is our guest. He's a polar explorer, and he's been at this for more than 20 years, doing solo trips in places where many people probably will never go. I know in Antarctica there are scientific communities. I don't know how many are in the interior. They mostly seem to be sort of along the edges of that grand continent. So when you're off 1,000 miles into the ice, into the snow, do you have a way to communicate? Do you carry radio satellites?
Well, depends. The first trip in 95, I didn't have anything, no radio. And that was before satellite phones and things like that. On the second Antarctica trip, I had a HF radio, so I could rig up this huge antenna, and if I was lucky, there was going to be someone in the other end, faint voice there, depending on the solar activity and things like that. But now it's so much easier.
Well, just because you said you had to, that first crossing of Antarctica, you had to make arrangements in case something had happened, and I'm assuming
so
that's insurance.
You bring a kind of an emergency beacon where you can turn on, and it sends a distress signal. So it's possible to tell people that something is going wrong, but not so much else.
Are there always humans on the edges of Antarctica, or are they only there in the...
There are some of the bases, they have people wintering over. And at the South Pole, there is a base with people wintering over, maybe 30 to 40 people wintering over. But at the summer, it's maybe 300-400.
We talked about the effects of climate change at the North Pole. Do you see similar kinds of impacts of warming in the South Pole, Antarctica?
No, you don't see it that much down there. And the reason is that it's a much colder continent. So
I just shivered. He laughed.
So you still have a rise in temperature. But when it goes from minus 20 to minus 18 or something like that, you're still on minus Celsius. But if it goes from plus or minus 1 to plus 1 than everything else. So that's what's special about Arctic. It's much closer to zero. But you also you do have impacts on warmings in Antarctica, especially on the peninsula, because that's sticking out in the ocean with greater loss of ice masses than before. But for my expeditions in the interior of Antarctica, I don't really see it.
You know, it's interesting. Many of us have seen those lovely pictures of Antarctica, and I've actually met people who do ice coring samples, and you've met those people as well on your trips. But for virtually all of us, we only get information about what these continents are like from people like yourself, or we might see movies, or we see those very sad movies of stranded polar bears in the North Pole, where when the ice cap has started to break. So, what responsibility do you have as an explorer to talk to us, to communicate that?
Well, my responsibility, I feel, is first of all to be a kind of an eyewitness to the climate change and to be a visual example of what's going on. And that's what we wanted to do with that circumnavigation of the Arctic, which we did in 2010 and sailed around the Arctic. And we chose a very small boat, a small trimaran in fiberglass, so not a big steel hull that could push ice. It was really a lightweight, fragile vessel, and we sailed around the Arctic in 4 months and did a trip that would have taken 6 years, 100 years ago, and just a few decades ago it wouldn't have been possible because all the ice clogging up the straits and the narrow channels. So it's still ice up there, of course, but much less than before. So I think people are a little bit confused, and they read all the scientific report with so and so many square kilometers of ice disappearing, right. But it doesn't really mean anything to the guy in the street. But if we could sail around the Arctic with a small trimaran in 4 months to a trip that was impossible just 10 years ago, that's a very visual example.
How long will you continue to do this?
there, I don't have a time or end year. I think I will still continue to do adventure, and that's the main reason why I do it, because I love it. I like to be out there. I'm having fun out there. And if you like nature and if you like adventure, that's a reason in itself. So I often get the question why, but still it's not one answer, and it's several answers, but the simplest answer is because I like it.
And will you continue to make the solo treks?
I haven't done solo treks for a few years. I did 4 big solo expeditions, and you can do just so much more together with other people. So now I started to team up with other people again.
And on your website, you can see the team members, all of whom are covered with ice. Mark Ausland, not covered with ice today. He's a polar explorer. He's written a number of books. The latest is called The Great Polar Journey in the Footsteps of Nansen. And Mark Ausland's going to be speaking tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at Seattle's Benaroya Hall. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
In a minute here, we're going to turn from polar exploration to pop culture exploration with last night's Academy Awards ceremony. Who won what? Who wore what? Who danced and sang what? Stick around.
Support for KUOW comes from Citizen University, a conference on the art of great citizenship featuring playwright and screenwriter Tony Kushner on the lessons of the film Lincoln and dozens of luminary speakers. March 23rd at Seattle Center. Registration at citizenuniversity.us.
On the next Living on Earth, high gas prices are pushing demand down, taking a toll on greener fuel as well.
There's too much ethanol chasing too little market in the United States. It is really tough to make money in ethanol today.
America's corn ethanol in trouble. I'm Steve Kerwood. Join me for that next time on Living on Earth from PRI, Public Radio International.
tonight at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to innovative ways to keep cows comfortable with bedding, cushioned walkways, misters, and nutritional and medical care. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
44 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:39. Confusion regarding Italy's election results are resulting in fears of an unstable government and throwing financial markets into turmoil. A full report from NPR in 20 minutes.
Here's to all the losing works of art, from Lincoln to Amour.
To the disappointed actors wondering what they dressed up for.
Now the real performance starts. With phony smiles at the ball. Here's to the losers. Bless them all.
Amen.
Who was the loser last night? Maybe it was the viewer. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. Every year, I join hundreds of millions of my fellow global citizens to watch the Academy Awards broadcast, which were not called the Academy Awards. They were called the Oscars. This year's show had a new host, but much of the same behind-the-scenes jockeying. So, listeners, what did you think about it? Who was the biggest loser and the biggest winner in the telecast? Our phone number, 206-543-KUOW. And joining us to talk about what you probably already are discussing this morning, wherever you are, the Oscars, the Academy Awards, that thing with the gold statue. Playwright and critic David Schmader's here. He's an associate editor at The Stranger, author of solo plays that include Letter to Axel, Short-Term Solution to a Long-Term Problem, et cetera, et cetera. Also with us, Sandy Siafi, film and video artist, teacher as well. She's teaching media at Seattle Central Community College and Seattle University, working on documentaries. And unless I missed one, the last completed picture was called Sweet Crude.
That's right.
Okay, good. Well, so we just heard Kristen Chenoweth and Seth MacFarlane chortling at the end of the Oscars. And got to start with the host of the show. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean,
they just shook their heads at one another.
So much fantastic Twitter chatter already. So I'll try to say something new, or at least newish.
Okay.
I mean, I was laughing thinking about the night as a global night and thinking about Berlusconi, who's possibly back, and how grateful he must be to know that he's actually not out of step with what was such absurd, horrible, old school sexism that's just not even funny. I mean, it's one thing if it's edgy, and that's all well and good, but not funny is not okay. So I was thinking about Berlusconi singing We Saw Your Boobs while watching election results.
We should probably lay out some of the components that built this tower of old school sexism, which there was
in case somebody wasn't watching.
Okay, and also David. Just to take time to make fun of it too.
Okay, David.
So the boob song, it was about same girl actress's boobs, and he went one by one, you know, to their faces, saying whether it was. And then the little niggly stuff, like Zero Dark Thirty, was eventually turned into like a woman nags her way to killing Osama bin Laden movie.
Exactly.
Like this weird honeymooners type. Ladies, oh my God.
And
all they want to do is go shopping.
Let's add that the movies that he called out in the We Saw Your Boobs, when I looked at the movies he called out, they were all, with a few exceptions, really excellent films in which the scenes that women had their boobs shown were meaningful scenes. So it seemed particularly sort of weird and garish to make fun of it, like he was talking about teensploitation films or something like that.
Right. And then it had that really grating framing of like, I know this is naughty, so I'm showing this as it was shown as an outtake of like what might have happened if Seth MacFarlane was allowed to do whatever he wanted with the Oscars. And it would be talk like a retarded frat boy.
Do we add the added gender insult of the gay men's chorus part? I'm not certain that I understand if that
innocent
was just random. Just random. Innocent bystanders.
Well, then it got the folks I was watching with to wonder whether this is Seth MacFarlane or whether it was the team of writers. I mean, who writes this stuff? And does he have the final say as host?
It felt very much of his writing style. I don't watch Family Guy much. I watch enough of it to know that I don't like it. And it's a lot of just these kind of random cutaways. And he had the very, very similar style with the opening of like, what might have happened if this happened? And then they stage it.
Right.
And
so endlessly.
So it felt very much like at least he was steering the tone, and it was written very specifically for him.
Also very much to me the case that seemed kind of desperate that they're trying to figure out their demographic. So they changed their name because they think Academy Awards sounds too stodgy, so they go to Oscar. Last year they tried the young crowd with James Franco and Anne
Hathaway. That was 2 years ago. Last year we went back to the old crowd.
That's right.
Oh,
that's
my
right.
Gosh. Yeah.
And, you know, the Academy itself is... I think median age is 62 and, you know, 92% Caucasian. All that being said, they're desperately trying to find the demographic. So what was really weird about his opening bit was, okay, we're going to be for the 13-year-old boys right now. By the same token, make a reference to The Flying Nun, which worked. I mean, could have worked for me if it had been funny. I would have enjoyed it. But I couldn't figure out, well, what demographic exactly still has the actual sensibility of a 13-year-old boy but watched The Flying Nun? I'm not sure if that's a wide demographic.
We're talking about the Oscars. That's Sandy Siafi, filmmaker, and she teaches media around. So there you go. She's an authority in that way. David Schmader, playwright, writer, maybe you and I are just the occasional watchers or the regular watchers. I've been watching this show for several decades,
I should say.
So, listeners, maybe you love Seth MacFarlane, and I want to hear from you because, in fact, I didn't know who he was. I confess, I'm an old, middle-aged woman. I had no clue who he was, and I had to look him up, and there you have it. Judy's in Issaquah. What do you think, Judy?
I could not agree more with every single thing that was just said. I was with five women, and we're over 50, but I just felt like he knew that he wasn't doing what most people really wanted to hear. And what I wonder was, what did Hollywood actually think about all of it? You know, sometimes they pan the audience when comments are made and people are laughing or they're not laughing. They didn't do that last night. So I'm thinking I don't think it was very well received by the audience either.
Huh, that's an
interesting point.
Yeah, thanks, Judy. In case you didn't watch last night and you were doing something like watching the real Marines talking about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, which was the counter programming on CBS. Here is a clip from the opening long act of Seth MacFarlane.
Captain Kirk, what are you doing here?
Well, I'm here to stop you from doing what you're about to do. The show's a disaster.
What are you talking about? It's going fine.
No, it's not. Listen to me. I've come back in time from the 23rd century to stop you from destroying the Academy Awards. This is a newspaper headline from tomorrow morning.
Seth MacFarlane, worst Oscar host ever. Is that bad?
Your jokes are tasteless and inappropriate, and everyone ends up hating you.
That was William Shatner, who appeared for a long time on a big screen behind Seth MacFarlane. And was he the worst host of all time? I mean, he sort of opened himself up to that one.
He did. Well, and I think he probably wins over James Franco and Anne Hathaway because at least you felt for them a little bit, or at least you felt for Anne Hathaway, and you felt for James Franco for smoking too much weed before the ceremony. But this time, there's no empathy naturally extending from me to Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, and when you smoke too much weed, you're not mean-spirited. And I think there's that distinction. I think one of the important things to me about it, whether it was Seth himself or some overall sort of zeitgeist, it seemed to me like this night of backlash against meaning. It was a backlash against, I think, a lot of progress that the entertainment industry helped to usher in the last year. And it seemed to me like we wanted to act like we're post-meaning or something. Like, oh, concerns about sexism and racism and homophobia are so 20th century. We're all past that. So we can wink and nod at each other and pretend that that stuff just doesn't matter. After all, don't you want to have a good time and wear a metallic dress? I mean, are you really that heavy? You can't just laugh about everything. And I think that really, it also sort of seemed to me like all night you didn't think you knew exactly what was wrong until Daniel Day-Lewis was actually funny. And then you realized, oh, actually funny and not mean-spirited and meaningful.
Yeah, well, let's talk about highlights. That was one for me as well. Other highlights, were there many?
I was happily surprised by Christoph Waltz winning a second Best Supporting Actor just because he's super good. And it's great that it somehow landed in his favor. This feels like a lottery, but I'm glad he won the lottery twice.
Well, so that's good. Highlights for you, Sandy?
Yeah, and though a friend of mine had a competing film in the category, I think Innocente winning for documentary short. And oftentimes when the documentary filmmakers get up, the whole audience has that moment of, oh, look, it's real people with real bodies and, you know, a real...
Spoken like a documentary filmmaker.
Yes, with a very real body. And, you know, and you get that feeling that everyone in the audience has the authenticity moment. And I think last night was lacking so utterly in authenticity moments, even... spontaneity of any sort, like that horrible joke about the kilt that landed really flat to me. I just happened to be wearing a kilt when everyone said you were going to win, and that was awful. So sorry, you said to be positive for a minute.
Yeah.
And I should be. So to be positive, it is always really lovely to have millions, if not maybe a billion, they say, people get exposed to the fact that there are these really different sorts of films out there. And then they go out and rent them. And in some cases, the nominees alone get column inches for issues. So, you know, How to Survive a Plague and Invisible War, though they didn't win, because they were nominated, there are all kinds of news outlets that have now covered those stories, which is why many of us fight so hard to even get close to being shortlisted. Because while we might complain about award season, if you win one, the cause that you cared about gets attention.
That's heartening to hear, because I was very disappointed in the long-form documentary, because it's such a great story, but it's not that great of a movie. It could have been an awesome This American Life story. It could have been anything.
And that's the Searching for Sugar Man, which
just
won.
The real-life story of Rodriguez is so astounding. It makes you cry.
I agree with you completely. And I think the new documentary rules are why that film won, and that's a concern for every documentary.
And what are the new documentary rules?
It used to be the case that a group of people who were considered within the Academy to be more sort of expert in that field were choosing that particular award, even on the early end, were deciding who to nominate. And the process for getting even qualified is very difficult. And they've changed that. And ostensibly, they changed it to make it more fair so that things that had more money and made for TV wouldn't qualify. But that's not necessarily what's happened. So there's a lot of chatter about how to fix it. And I think the fact that the entire Academy voted tended towards something more entertaining, which documentaries are already fighting that tidal wave. So I actually really agree with that. I wanted to point out that at least those nominees got attention. But Invisible War was a far better film by leaps and bounds. So it is difficult. Yeah.
We're talking over last night's Oscar telecast, and Janice and Magnolia called in. You are a Seth MacFarlane fan?
I am. I'm a huge MacFarlane fan. I was very excited see him yesterday evening. I'm very disappointed with the material and incredibly offended as a woman by some of the things that happened on that show. Disappointing.
Janice, we were talking a little bit earlier about whether this reflected Seth, and did you get the sense that he felt comfortable with this material? I didn't exactly.
I think that for the first time he may have had writers that let him down. I also think that he went on board with what happened wholeheartedly as best he could. I love William Shatner. I didn't like Seth's attempt to warn everybody that they might be offended and they might not like his performance. I thought it was self-serving. And he's a very intelligent, talented man. And I was deeply disappointed by what he apparently signed on to.
Well, thanks for calling in. Christopher also is a Seth MacFarlane fan. He says, I'm a 53-year-old gay man who's been watching the Oscars since I was a child. You people need to lighten up. That's the whole point of Seth's material. You totally missed the point, proving how out of touch your point of view is and why the Oscars have declining viewership. I found this particular show the best in years and found Seth totally charming. Dominic writes in, Daniel Day-Lewis highlighted the sub-Ricky Gervais standard of humor, and Ricky Gervais is sub-Ricky Gervais. Let's hear a little bit of Daniel Day-Lewis's acceptance speech.
It's a strange thing because 3 years ago, before we decided to do a straight swap, I had actually been committed to play Margaret Thatcher. Meryl was Stephen's first choice for Lincoln. And I'd like to see that version. Stephen didn't have to persuade me to play Lincoln, but I had to persuade him that perhaps if I was going to do it, that Lincoln shouldn't be a musical.
That's part of Daniel Day-Lewis, who won his third Academy Award for acting. And so let's leave Seth MacFarlane aside and talk about these big awards. Was that deserved? Should he have won?
Did you see Lincoln? I did not see Lincoln, but I understand that he deserved it 100%. In the way that they gave it to him a third time, which they often do to just like make a point, like you're another species of actor.
Right. And I mean, he's amazing. And I thought it was so many layers of humor that he referred to Meryl Streep, because first of all, he didn't play the coy, oh, I had no idea I'd win, since every odds maker in the world thought he would. So we had something prepared. And I think that's actually charming. But I also thought that the fact is he's in the style of actor in that film where he's literally embodying someone else. And it's always an interesting conversation whether that kind of challenge up against creating a character from nothing, those things are different exercises. So it's difficult that they're in the same category sometimes. But much like Meryl Streep, he was such an extraordinary impersonator of Lincoln that you can't even get past that. That said, you know, there were some other performances this year that really were outstanding. It was a pretty outstanding year for performances.
What about Jennifer Lawrence as Best Actress?
I was excited. I saw that movie. I thought she did a terrific job. She was my favorite part of it. And I'm just pro her. She seems to be she seemed to have watched Kristen Stewart's career trajectory and been like, okay, I'm going to figure this out differently.
Yeah.
And so she's just doing everything right, and she's good at her job. So hurrah. And I like falling.
And if it means people watch Winter's Bone again, right, there's nothing but good that comes from that, yeah.
Well, what's interesting is when they were showing the clips, there weren't enough clips, I have to say. I like more movie. It's about movies, so I wanted to see more movie clips and less live musical performance. That's just me. The music was fine. But when I saw most of those movies, and when I saw again the clip of Jessica Chastain in Zero Dark Thirty, that movie's problematic, but she's amazing. She was the reason that movie was even nominated, I think. So I started thinking about different kinds of roles and comedic roles and, you know, the sort of serious stuff that tends to get nominated. And just the idea that you know, we have Zero Dark Thirty and then we have Silver Linings Playbook, and everyone said that could never win. I loved that movie for a lot of reasons. Zero Dark Thirty had many, many problems. Then you have Lincoln, which was the early on odds favorite, but it was too ponderous, so it couldn't win. So Argo got to win. And, you know, so what do you think about all that weird behind the scenes stuff?
It felt weirdly festival-y. It seemed like at Cannes, where everyone like, oh, you win director, but you don't win picture. That awards get given out with kind of more thoughtfully with festivals, and this seemed to echo it either on purpose or not. I kind of liked the grab bag of no sweep for anything. And after I saw Argo, I was like, that movie will win. There's no way that movie won't win.
And it did. Did you put money on it?
I don't know. I'm not a betting man.
It also pointed out that really big distinction in American mainstream film and indie and European film. The challenge for Jessica Chastain is that in her film, she's largely speaking only given really one note, even though the film takes place over 10 years. It's not a character study. It's so plot, plot, plot that she doesn't really have anywhere to go. Whereas Jennifer Lawrence has a lot of places to go, and she goes there and everywhere else. And I think that, you know, if you look at Amour and Beasts of the Southern Wild, these are films that really are not so plot, plot, plot. I mean, in fact, in some cases in Beasts of the Southern Wild, you're sort of a bit confused about what's happening in the bathtub, you know, but you are so drawn in by characters.
Well, I actually thought the father in Beasts of the Southern Wild should have had the nomination. I thought the little girl was adorable, but, you know, she was adorable. But I thought the guy who played the father sort of...
Absolutely ignored, and that made no sense, yeah.
And he is not an actor. He's just
a
somebody
baker,
who was around.
A baker,
yes,
I think
we all heard the same thing. But yes, amazing. But
best film, what would you have picked, Sandy?
Of that crowd.
Oh, well, you can pick any film you want.
If I'm voting in that crowd, I probably think the film of the year was Amour, technically. But I would think of the films that had a fighting chance, I actually probably would have voted for Argo. Just in terms of structurally and what it did. And in the world of telling history perhaps too soon, or should a narrative film say it's true, all those philosophical questions, in that world, I would have thought Argo was less egregious in some ways than the other two big ones that maybe should have kind of been more documentary-like. I guess I'd go there.
And of these things that weren't nominated, the movies that you saw that were fantastic?
Well, I loved Moonrise Kingdom. I just don't understand why Moonrise Kingdom and Perks of Being a Wallflower were such extraordinary films this year. And I think Moonrise Kingdom had a nomination, but I don't know if Perks even had a nom. And it was such a good movie.
I haven't seen it. Now I'm excited.
But you and me both. We'll end with this one. I loved watching the Oscars when I was little. Last night, I tuned partway through the broadcast with my 11 and 8-year-old daughters, who enjoy commenting on the gowns. Me too. Less than 10 minutes later, the crass Ted bit caused me to turn it off, and they were disappointed. I was disappointed. Everybody was disappointed. Does the 13-year-old boy mentality rule everything, Joanne? That is a good question, which we cannot answer here because we've reached the end of our time. David Schmaders, associate editor at The Stranger, the author of a number of solo plays. Sandy Siafi is a Seattle-based film and video artist working on a new film, teaching at Seattle University and Seattle Central Community College. Thanks, both of you, for being here. Bernard Willett's our engineer. Weekday produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher on KUOW.
To 10, feel the earth move, and then hear my heart burn.
10:59. South Korea now has its first female president. More in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.